Good evening and welcome to the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. Today is August 30th, 2018. It's a Friday. Getting ready for the weekend. Going to change it up a little bit today for our show. I would like to talk about, because the question gets posed to me quite often, how in the world does somebody get into cybersecurity or information security? How do you do it? How do you get your first job? What skills do you need? And then what's your day-to-day life like at that job? What are you doing day in, day out? So I'm going to touch on some of that stuff. And if we have time, we'll do a couple of newsworthy items for cryptocurrency side. I'm going to pretty much stay with mining and some of the updates around that I've seen here recently. But we'll kick it off with the cybersecurity stuff. And how do you get into cybersecurity to begin with? And what skills do you need? The path is different for everybody, really. The path that I took was a little different. I started off just in regular IT. I went to school for information technology, learned how to do networking and, you know, configure routers, switches, servers, whatever it is, operating systems of all types. And so I did some general IT work for about 10 years. And that really shaped my foundation of knowledge. I learned so much about so many different things during those 10 years. And that's a long time to be working in one field. And about, 7 years into that, I decided that, you know, security was taking off. And I thought, man, right now is a really good time to get into this field. So I went back to school, got another degree in information security, and got some certifications, and then applied at every single job I could possibly find that was information security related, and finally got a chance. So the hardest part, even though I'd been in IT for 10 years, I was unproven in information security. And that's always the hardest part. That's always, it's even tough with your first IT job. You're unproven. You have no experience. But I had all the IT experience in the world, and IT and security, they obviously go hand in hand, but when you're an IT person, you understand why things need to be secure and what needs to be secure. So the fact that I couldn't find a job for the longest time because nobody would give me a chance because I had no direct information security experience was extremely frustrating. But of course, once I got the first job, and then, you know, the second job it's always way easier to get your second job in that same field. And IT was the same way. I had to start off low and work my way up in IT. And, you know, towards the end of just my IT life, I was doing anything and everything. I mean that literally. I'd do anything from setting up a new printer to, you know, configuring a new domain controller. Or setting up a web server and, you know, a Linux web server and configuring a new firewall. I mean, you name it. I was responsible for doing it, even all the little low-level stuff like running wires and all that stuff. I was doing every bit of it. So I learned, made a lot of mistakes, but had a lot of successes as well, and I learned so much from that. And for me, the transition to information security was, you know, at least knowledge-wise, was extremely easy. I already had the IT knowledge. I understood the inner workings of all the technologies for the most part. You know, obviously, I don't know everything. But I understood the majority of it. And I knew how things connected and how to connect things, how to architect things. So I already had that base foundation of knowledge, and security is just kind of a, you know, I looked at it almost at the time like, this is kind of no-brainer stuff. Like, of course I need to secure this. Duh. Why is this so hard? Why is this so difficult for people to understand? It seems like no-brainer stuff. But when you get into it more and more and more, and you actually become the security guy, and you start telling people they need to do these things that you think are kind of duh, there are ramifications for doing those things. It could impact productivity of your employees. It could impact how useful one of your systems is, which could also impact productivity. It could slow down a system because we're doing additional filtering, which can also affect productivity. People also have a very rigid routine at work. It's almost incredible how rigid people's routine is. You know, they wake up every day at the same time, they go to work at the same time, they stay at work until the same time, and then they leave for the day. The routine is very set in stone. And this goes for all the things that they do on their computer while they're at work. And so, when you disrupt that flow and that routine, even just a little bit, just for a second or two, people get angry. And it's amazing to see how much people can be disrupted by one little change. As an example, I've been really pushing for two-factor at my job, and the pushback that I get from everybody is, oh, that takes too long. It takes too long? Really? You open your phone and you hit accept. Why is that taking too long? You know, it could probably take you 3 to 5 seconds. You know, maybe less. If you know the alert is coming, just keep your phone open and just hit accept. But people don't want to do that. The only way that they wanted to do it was if they could get the alert for two-factor, the push notification, on their smartwatches, because that was somehow easier. So there's always some give and take, and, you know, people will definitely push back and they'll fight you on different things depending on how much you're going to disrupt their day-to-day routine. So that's always the delicate tightrope you have to walk as a security professional. You know, you have to say, okay, how much is this going to affect productivity? How much is this going to affect end users? Are they going to be mad at me? And it's a lot to shoulder. It's a lot to think about. But we all have to go through it. We all do it. But it's a lot to think about. On the flip side, as the end users, they create the biggest vulnerabilities in the environment. And they will never admit to it. You go and ask somebody, hey, what happened here on your computer? Why are you getting all these pop-ups? Oh, I don't know what happened. I have no idea. I was just in my email and Outlook, and just all of a sudden, everything just popped up. I don't know what happened. Obviously, that's a lie. They did something. It doesn't just magically happen. In most cases. Oftentimes, they've clicked on something they didn't realize, or whatever it is, but they always want to throw up their hands and say, I don't know what you're talking about. I would never do that. No, I didn't do that. I didn't click on that. And as you start, you know, going down the rabbit hole and investigating everything that they've done on their computer, and you come back to them and say, hey, look, it looks like you did click on this link and it looks like it did take you to this website and created a bunch of, you know, pop-ups, and this is what infected your computer. And then they all of a sudden have a revelation, like, oh, yeah, I think I remember that now. And as the security professional, you have to pretend like you believe them. Even though in your heart of hearts you're saying, come on, man, really? Seriously? You didn't know that you did this until I told you that you did? Come on. People just don't want to admit that they've made a mistake. And that's something you have to always keep in the back of your mind. In the end, your users are your customers. They are what give you a job. If they weren't there, you would not be employed. That's always something to keep in mind, too. So you don't treat them like crap just because they've clicked on their link and, you know, infected their computer with the worst virus on the planet. You leave that up to executives to make those kinds of decisions. If somebody gets CryptoLocker and it encrypts every single file on all of the file servers, all right, you report that to management and executive management and let them decide what to do with the person that clicked. Because the person that clicked is going to tell you, I didn't do that. No, I don't know what happened. They're going to play dumb. And all you can do is just say, okay, I'm going to look into this and see what I can find. You know, it's all right. I'll see what I can find. We'll see what happens. And just kind of placate them for a little while until you can investigate and see what actually happened on their computer. And oftentimes you'll see that they did click on something they weren't supposed to, which infected their computer with ransomware or whatever it is. It happens. It happens all the time. And the biggest threat vector that you know, all of these malicious viruses and phishing and all this stuff, the biggest threat vector is still email. It's still email. Amazingly enough, email will be the bane of your existence if you're an information security professional. So many things get through email. So many viruses get through email. So many links get through email filters. They get through any kind of filtering that you've got. And the ones that really, you know, it's so hard to stop are the ones where they spoof the display name of your CEO, let's say. Let's say it's Bob Smith. And so when the user sees an email from Bob Smith, they don't read the email address that it's coming from. They just see that the name is Bob Smith. Oh, God, that's my CEO. And there's no links in the message. There's no attachments. It's simply Bob Smith telling whoever that you need them to, that Bob Smith needs them to wire money to him because he's out of the country doing X, Y, and Z. Those are always the toughest emails to defend against because there's no links, there's nothing to scan for. There's nothing malicious attached to the email or no malicious links in the email. It's just text. So those are always very difficult. And email will definitely be the bane of your existence if you're a security professional. A lot of times in the security realm, you'll be wearing multiple hats. You'll be doing, you know, you'll be managing, in some cases, every single security system that the company has, which is what I'm doing in my case. So I'm managing 8 different systems and administering those 8 systems, which is fine. I love doing it. I'm not complaining. But in other jobs, you'll be so siloed off that you only focus on one little thing, and that's it. You're in your own little bubble, in your own little silo. You don't venture into anybody else's silo. You stay in your lane, and you stay out of everybody else's way. That is the kind of job, to me, that, yeah, you probably start off there, and it's a good starting point to learn one system really, really, really well and get your feet wet. But over time, you're going to be extremely bored with doing the same thing for years on end. You're going to want to change. You're going to want to be able to do something new. So when you start looking for a job, some of the things that you need to have, of course, first and foremost, you need to have some sort of drive. And you need to have a really big passion for technology in general. If you don't have passion for technology, don't bother going into IT or information security, either one. Don't bother, because you'll hate it. If you love technology and you love just getting any new piece of tech and just tinkering with it and seeing what all you can do with it, just to play around in your spare time, then you know that you'd be a great person for an IT job. So when you go in for an interview, whether it's an IT job or information security job, you have to show that passion to the interviewer. You have to show them how passionate you are. You know, tell them all the things that you've done at home recently with any new, you know, tech that you've used, any new tweaks that you've done to make your network, you know, more secure, whatever it is. Show that passion in that interview room. Because hiring managers, especially for a technical job, they're going to want to see that passion. If you come in and all you have is, you know, some degrees and some certifications, but when you go home every night, you don't even look at a computer. You don't even want to touch your phone. You don't want to think about technology when you get off work. If that comes across in an interview, they're probably not going to hire you. They want somebody that's going to be passionate, that loves technology, that loves how all of it works, and loves to be around it all the time. That's what employers want. And I guarantee you, if you show that passion, you'll have a much easier time getting that first job, even with no experience. So that's first and foremost. You got to have passion to do what you do. You have to be very passionate. And don't let anything stand in the way of that passion. Nothing at all is going to get in your way of your passion. It doesn't matter how rude people are to you when their computer breaks or when you decide to crank down the antivirus level and you quarantine something that they needed and they get really mad at you. Don't ever let that deter you. Keep that passion and keep going. End users don't want to be disrupted in any way, shape, or form, so they don't understand. But you understand it. It's not their fault that they don't understand, but you understand more of how it works. So keep that in your mind, that this is what you love to do. And no matter how hard you try, people will still get mad at you because their computer's not working right, or, you know, whatever it is, people will get mad at you for those things. It's not directly your fault. There was some sort of a failure with that system. It happens. Failure happens. Keep that passion. The other big thing, and I don't like it, but it is the way it is right now, to get past HR and all the screenings that HR does is, You know, when you send in your resume, HR has automatic screening to look for anything with, you know, a specific certification. And if that certification is not listed, then it immediately goes in the trash pile. Immediately. And that's, while that's a shame, that's the way it is, unfortunately. So, if you can get a certification of some sort, doesn't matter what, even if it's the lowest level certification that you can possibly get, get one. Get one and start that foundation. Because once you get one, you're going to be hungry to get another one. And then you'll be hungry to get another one. And you'll want to keep advancing your career. If you can go to school and get a degree as well, that's going to do nothing but help. Some jobs require a bachelor's degree and a certification. But for entry level, at least a bare minimum of a certification and a whole lot of enthusiasm and passion will get you your first job. It will. You may not get offers from every company that you interview with, but you got to keep trying. You got to keep interviewing and keep on going. And somebody will see that passion in you and they will give you a chance. I would also, if you're trying to break into the field, whether IT or InfoSec, write down all of the projects that you've done outside of work so that you can talk about them in those interviews. When the interviewer says, "Tell me about yourself," that's when you prattle on about all the things that you've done and how passionate you are. Don't tell them that you're passionate, but show that passion to them by telling them all the things that you've done recently as it relates to that particular job. Another trick of the trade is to tweak your resume for the type of position you are applying for. Now, I'm not saying lie on your resume. I'm saying tweak it so that it's more friendly to that particular type of job. So, we've all worked with, you know, tons of different technologies, but that particular job, they're wanting, like, you know, two or three different things. So, you tailor your resume to show that you've worked with those two or three different things, not the thousands of other tools that you've worked with. So, always keep that stuff in mind when you're going in for an interview. Try to get a certification, too. They're not cheap. Some of them require experience to officially give you the certification, but you can at least go and pass the test and have an associate CISSP, for example. And then they require you to have 4 years of experience before you actually get the CISSP. But go do it at least. Go take the test. You know, get that associate level at least. Show that you're passionate, show that you're trying. And when an employer sees that and they see that you're actually trying and you just want to make something of yourself, you're going to get a job. And you'll do just fine if you have that passion. As far as day-to-day life goes, depending on how siloed off you are, if you're siloed off and you only do one thing, like let's say you manage the antivirus, all you're going to be focused on is managing antivirus. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. If you wear multiple hats, that's where it gets interesting. From my perspective, at least thus far in my career, the biggest threat is always going to be email. That's where the majority of the threats are going to come from. I mean, something like, I think it's more than 90% of all breaches that have ever happened started with a phishing email. Those are scary statistics to think about. So if you're wearing multiple hats and somebody gets infected and you're investigating that, you're doing triage and you're doing forensics type work and you're looking to see what happened, 90% of the time you're going to trace it back to a malicious email. So if you're the sole practitioner or security person at your job, you're the only person doing it, the biggest threat vector that you want to lock down is email. It's not easy to lock it down. There's always new techniques these guys are using. I've even seen where they put links inside of a PDF document so that spam filters can't scan inside of a PDF because it's a flat link. And so the spam filter doesn't even see it as a link, even if it goes through the document on a PDF. So they're doing all kinds of things. They're spoofing. They are doing everything that they can to attack you and to get into your systems and to trick your users and get passwords. That is the number one threat that you want to be concerned with. From there, you just need to layer on the security. But going into your first gig, and let's say you're the only security person, I would be extremely worried about what protections they have around email. So some companies won't want to invest in any sort of email filtering, and some will have tons of money and they'll just throw all kinds of money at different tools. The problem becomes if you have too many tools and they're not working in harmony, then you're wasting your money. So you got to have the right tool set. You got to have the right everything, really. You got to have the right people. You got to have the right processes. And you got to have the right technology. That's just the way it is. If you're missing any one of those three things, your security program and security in general at wherever you are is not going to be successful. You got to have those three pillars: people, process, and technology. Those are so pertinent to any security job and the success of your security program. So day to day at your first job, you may just be assigned to go and put out fires with people that have gotten, you know, infected with a virus. And all they want you to do is go grab the computer and re-image it. It's not much of a security gig, but it's a start. Start somewhere. And then when you get in somewhere, that is your chance. If you get in with a big company and there's tons of room to grow, that is your biggest opportunity. That's your biggest opportunity. And you have to start out small. That's just the way it is. You start out small and you work your way up. When you get in there, show that passion to the executives, to your manager. Show how passionate you are. Show how enthusiastic you are. Show how motivated you are. If you do that, you'll be successful. You will. So that's all I'm going to ramble about for cybersecurity stuff. I hope that helps some new folks that are trying to get into cybersecurity. And I think some of those things are even valid for any type of job, really. You know, it's not just security jobs that you need to be passionate for. It's every job. Every job that you take, You need to have some passion. You need to be excited about what you're doing, or you're going to hate your life. You're going to hate your job. You're going to hate everything that you do every day. Find something that you like. Find something that you want to do, and it won't feel like work. That's probably the hardest part, is to find that niche. Find what works best for you. But I'm going to quit blabbing about that stuff. We're going to jump over to cryptocurrency. Ethereum has a major upgrade coming up in October. Or at least that's what they're planning for. So hopefully that will actually happen. They're proposing quite a few changes. One of those changes being that there will only be 2 Ethereum created per block, whereas before it was 3 created per block. They're also looking to potentially change the algorithm so that they can prevent ASIC miners from, you know, taking over all of the mining. If you're not familiar with ASIC miners, it's specially built hardware specifically for one type of algorithm. And that algorithm can be essentially used to create these ASIC chips, processing chips, and they create the chip in such a way that it processes that algorithm, you know, 100 times faster than any graphics card would, for example. So they are proposing to potentially change the algorithm of Ethereum. This is obviously still all up in the air, but it's coming up in October, which is right around the corner here. But I thought that was rather interesting. I'm hoping that they're going to keep incentives for the miners up, because essentially that's what, you know, runs their network. And if they allow ASIC mining, you're going to have these huge companies like Bitmain, essentially creating these huge Bitcoin and Ethereum mining farms. And they would be the primary mining force that's going to find, you know, 70 or 80% of all blocks, and they will be getting the most reward. That's why they're looking to change that algorithm to prevent those ASIC miners from being created and mining with those. So again, still up in the air, but certainly interesting to look at. Personally, I've been mining for Metaverse. It's symbols ETP. If you want to check it out. It's been pretty profitable lately, but you know, it kind of fluctuates between Metaverse and Ethereum and a couple others. So I've been mining for Metaverse just to kind of change it up a little bit. The problem I've had with Metaverse is all the exchange rates. Not all the exchanges accept Metaverse. And to exchange it is, you know, killing any kind of money that I've made, essentially. So I'll eventually be switching back to Ethereum mining. But for now, I'm at least trying Metaverse. I'm going to stock up on some of that and then just hold on to it and see what happens. The price of Metaverse has gone up a little bit, too, so that's cool. But also, the more people that know that Metaverse is popular to mine for and also profitable, more people switch to it. So we are seeing a bunch of that. So there's a lot more people mining for Metaverse, which means that the difficulty level for Metaverse has also gone up quite a bit. So I'll probably be moving away from that eventually. But anyway, well, that's all I had for today. Just wanted to kind of change up the podcast today and talk about some different topics rather than just news-related items. But if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at eEnglish34, at eEnglish34 on Twitter. And it's the weekend, so I hope everybody has a good weekend, and we'll talk on Monday. Thanks for listening.